Hello, Blogging Heads viewers. My name is Eli Lake, and today I'm here with Steve Clemens, Vice President of the New America Foundation and proprietor of the popular political blog, The Washington Note. How are you today, Steve?
Hey, great to be with you, Eli.
Excellent. Well, let's start off and talk about Pakistan, where you were going, I guess. Today is a Wednesday, and we're in our fifth day of the constitutional crisis there and martial law in Islamabad. And I want to kind of get your impressions to start off. What do you think of the fairly strong condemnations coming from the Democratic field, particularly with regards to the Musharraf's imposition of martial law and suspension of courts and so forth?
I mean, I think in part what we see everybody doing right now is opportunistic gaming of a pretty crappy situation. Pervez Musharraf is someone who very early, when President Bush came out after 9/11, essentially said, "You're with us or you're against us." And Pervez Musharraf was one of the people with us, though he had usurped power at that time. And what really has set up a dynamic that I think is quite unhealthy is President Bush's second inaugural address, which really got everyone's expectations up that this was going to be a new and different kind of government, very committed to democracy promotion, a muscular kind of democracy promotion globally, and that, you know, I think the name of the president's speech is that there is no freedom without justice, or justice without freedom, or something of that sort. And I think now the president looks very hypocritical, when maybe he shouldn't look as hypocritical, because we do, in certain areas of the world, need to deal with non-democratic states, and that's just the reality of the world. But now we're stuck, and the president's not going to be able to give any, you know, robust pro-democracy speeches for the rest of his term because of what we're having to do with Musharraf today.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I think that in that second inaugural address, he had this great line where he said, "For years we pursued stability at the expense of liberty, and we got neither." And I think that that's the case really in Pakistan, because and I should say this. I mean, the State Department has been working for almost a year now in trying to deal Benazir Bhutto into some sort of power-sharing arrangement and to allow for constitutionally mandated elections. And they've decided to review the aid. They're not saying they're going to cut it off. So it's not necessarily one or the other. But I think that the...
But point you're saying, you know, we've been trying to deal Bhutto in.
Right.
At the same time, we've been trying to prop Musharraf up.
Yeah.
And think of yourself if you were a Pakistani nationalist and you realized that both of the two leaders that you had any real option of having, either together or separate, both appear to many people as to be puppets of American interest. And at the same time, guess who else is living in your country? Zawahiri and Osama bin Laden, somewhere in the country. And these are real problems. And so you see this sort of Talibanization and Al-Qaedization of part of the country that Musharraf and whoever comes along has to deal with.
Yeah.
And we're behind the two leading parts of the so-called democratic apparatus, trying to be democratic apparatus of Pakistan. I think that's a real problem.
Well,
and has been for some time.
Well, I mean, what I would say on that, though, a couple things. One, I think the success of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in the federally administered tribal areas has a lot to do with the failures of the Pakistani army. So Musharraf wasn't a particularly good son of a bitch, to use the Eisenhower phrase, in terms of, you know, he lost the military battle in those border provinces, probably in 2005, sort of made it official in 2006 with the original agreements with North and South Waziristan, and then those agreements have held and then been broken, and now they've been reinstituted. We just saw over the weekend a prisoner swap of Taliban prisoners for about 213 Pakistani army guys who were kidnapped.
Right.
So there's that. But I mean, I would say that, you know, it's not like we're looking to sort of create a power sharing agreement. We're looking for elections, and I think that there's a very strong argument to be made that Musharraf is hurting his own war against Al Qaeda by declaring emergency law, because you need a popular government that has legitimacy to do the sorts of things that he's going to need to do to root out the menace of Islamic supremacism in his own country right now. So there is an argument that it's in his interest to democratize, though it's in Musharraf's very narrow interest, obviously, to extort, you know, his patrons and say, "You need me more than I need you," and you know, cling to power however he so feels. So, I mean, I think that in some ways it can be a very bad deal when you put all of your eggs in the dictator basket.
Yeah, I mean, I agree, and we're stuck in a crappy situation. We've been there; it was predictable.
And they have nukes, Steve. I mean, it's potentially a
disaster. And they have nukes. But let me ask you a question. They have nukes. I've been saying for, I don't know, maybe close to a decade, that the most dangerous country in the face of the earth is Pakistan, that it was not Iraq, that it not North Korea even, not lots of other countries that you might put on lists. It's Pakistan, preceding the public knowledge, although there was a lot of private knowledge about it, I think a lot earlier than the New York Times reported about AQ Khan.
Yeah.
And others, that it was at the forefront of most of the scary scenario exercises that the CIA and Department of Defense would do in looking at kind of global instability and kind of ranking problems. And Pakistan was always right up there at the top of the list. So we should have no end of scenario gaming to have looked at various problems that we would face there, including, you know, military dictatorship and the kind of scenarios that we're looking at now. My question to you is, why do you think, given the fact that this administration has been at it now for nearly 7 years, why do you think we have failed so dramatically? I mean, it seems to me, and I've written this as well, that we have lost Pakistan, and that this White House that was trying to do something different in the Middle East, trying to build civil society institutions and saying it was about democracy, et cetera, nonetheless, when it came to the real front in the so-called war on terrorism, it was always there in Pakistan. Why do you think that we just have not invested as heavily as we should have, given the fact that they have nukes, in either bribing those warlords? I mean, there are any number of things that we might have done short of the hard-edged military invasion that we've always been advised by the Pakistanis not to do, but why have we gone on the cheap in other fronts?
Well, I'm not entirely sure that we have, but I think one distinction between the current regime in Pakistan and that of Iran or North Korea or Syria is the behavior of the regime and the fact that, you know, Musharraf at least has the decency to, if you want to take a very cynical view, lie to us the way the Saudis do, and at least has been in some cases, though I'm hardly a Musharraf apologist, but I don't think he's done enough, but he has cooperated with the CIA, he's cooperated with the U.S. military. The U.S. military takes targets of opportunity strikes in the federal administered tribal areas from Afghanistan, and he kind of tacitly allows it as long as, you know, he gets to claim that his military can take credit for it. Those are key distinctions between it with a regime like Iran, which has sort of made it pretty clear that they're an adversary and an enemy.
Yeah, but I mean, if Henry Kissinger were in place today, and we were under the Nixon administration, for instance, I can imagine that what somebody in government would be saying in the National Security Council is, we're deluding ourselves in thinking that religious fundamentalism of an extreme Islamist nature is what we're really dealing with in the western part of Pakistan and also in Afghanistan. We're dealing with self-dealing warlords who find radical Islam something to exploit and, frankly, something to extort for, and they're bribable. And bribing someone over time maybe gives you an opportunity to try to put forward some other opportunities for common interests. And maybe bribery is the wrong word. Sometimes we call it aid. Sometimes we call it development assistance and other things. But we have not, in my book, been investing anything near what one would want to do if one wanted to preclude a war, preclude a lot of other deaths among American men and women who are out in the field, to try to preclude that kind of, you know, new boiling point, that we could have invested far more than we are investing. And I'm just sort of interested in the neoconservative response, because it seems like the neocons are ready to jump on and ready to advocate harsh military action, but when it comes to the kind of things that might preclude us from getting there, I don't see a lot of cheerleading, and I'm just wondering why.
Well, I don't know. I don't necessarily know that that's the case. I mean, we've $9.6 billion is a lot of money since 9/11 that's been doled out to Pakistan. I have every reason to believe, their efforts to try to bribe warlords. I think that there is a to a certain extent, you're right, but it's also, I mean, Al-Qaeda also has a lot of money, and Al-Qaeda also has a lot of popular support, at least there. They don't think they have a lot of national support, but they do have popular support in that Pashtun tribal area. And, I mean, I just don't accept the premise of your question. I think that
right.
it has been tried. You know, we're talking about America. we try to bribe people all the time. I mean, I'm just saying, you know, I mean, so in that respect, I think...
No, I mean, it's a fair point. It's just one of,
yeah.
it's one of the... It, whether or not you felt as if we had invested enough...
I would go one further. I mean, you've got an obvious... I mean, nobody likes to talk about this, but it's pretty obvious that the ISI, their main security service, and probably elements of their military, are very infiltrated by the hardcore jihadist movement. So you've got a lot... I mean, it's sort of like asking the question, you know, like... You know, why haven't the cops failed to, you know, clean the corners of this obvious open-air drug market? Well, you know, sometimes the drug dealers are really good. And in that respect, I think, you know, Qaeda's got a lot of assets in the Pakistani military-industrial complex right now, including, I mean, we don't really know the full story on this, but, I mean, it looks like maybe AQ Khan himself was a sort of fellow traveler. So... we might be dealing with a deeper and broader cultural problems than a sort of fringe movement that's protected because you know by corruptible warlords.
You know, when I a few years ago I attended a conference and got there late, and one of the guys I was sitting with was from Pakistan, and I knew he was a general, but hadn't quite read the bios, and this was a man named Asad Durrani, one of the Durrani clan. Who was Pakistan's former ambassador to Saudi Arabia and to Germany, and also happened to be one of the former heads of the ISI. But not knowing that at the time, I asked him, so I said, do you think Musharraf really controls the ISI, or you think they're independent? And his response was, General Musharraf has a lot to gain from making it look like he doesn't control ISI.
Mm.
And I thought that was interesting in terms of the kind of chess moves and the complexity of these questions. That some of us are trying to figure out how the component pieces of authority in Pakistan are being doled out, where the Islamists are, what have they infiltrated, or what does Musharraf want people to think has been infiltrated? I think that that's another part, you know, part of this question, which is very interesting.
All right. Well, you know, speaking of Islamists, do you want to move to the Islamic Republic of Iran? And there's a lot of going on.
Yeah, and as we move to Iran, I want to make one point about Pakistan, which I think is not made enough. I feel kind of sorry for Musharraf, as much as the piling on and criticism of that he has. As I think, unlike you, perhaps, I look at the fact that, or I believe that America has been complicit in triggering and helping to hatch a lot of the unresolved problems in the Middle East, and also not responding to certain key grievances in the Middle East that have become bigger than states and become so big that what we've seen boiling up in Pakistan and Musharraf's inability to control or respond to it is a failure of our own as well on a sort of a larger macro level within the region. And it's likely to metastasize in other parts of the Middle East. I worry a lot about Jordan, Morocco, Egypt, and other places where we have similar kinds of arrangements with tough guys, autocracies or oligarchies at a minimum. And the Arab street is increasingly not with us. And as we move into Iran, I think that's a way to look at some of the big macro sort of questions, because we're talking about states. We may talk about Iran, we may talk about Iraq, we may talk about Israel-Palestine, but there's an interconnectedness of these things which is can overwhelm. And I think in part, to give some credit to Musharraf, that's in part happened there.
Well, it's funny. I mean, I actually agree that one of, if you wanted to call it a root cause, though, I guess a root cause of Islamic jihadism, though I don't think that Islamic jihadism is particularly overwhelmingly popular in the Middle East as some people say it is, but is the deficit of basic political freedoms, economic opportunities, and the sheer corruption of the family-owned sovereign states that sort of run most of the countries in the Islamic world. And when you have a choice between a Musharraf and, Zawahiri, you're going to increase the odds of Zawahiri getting support because the other option is so terrible, whereas it's in the civilized world's interest to expand the political options on offer to the Arab street And I think that that is ultimately going to lead to the downfall of this sort of reactionary and sadistic Islamic supremacy. I
hope that's the case, because what I fear is that a lot of that built-up resentment of their condition, their life, their opportunities, is also translating as an anti-Americanism, an anti-West attitude that the Zawahiris and Bin Ladens and Al-Qaedas are exploiting. And I find it fascinating. Karen Hughes is stepping down in her job as a chief public diplomacy spear carrier for the United States from her job in the State Department, and it's been remarkable that, given what you just said, that we haven't been able to turn that around. That's a very powerful force.
Well, we haven't turned it around because we haven't really done anything to change our relationship. In fact, we've strengthened our relationship with the friendly autocrats. That's what we've done. To a certain extent, I've always seen that the Bush administration's legacy will be one that he sort of oversaw this massive contradiction. There was the rhetoric of democracy. There was the war in Iraq, which was meant to try to create a democratic state in the middle of the Arab world. But then there was the rest of the sort of policy in the region, which was to subcontract the war against the jihadists to our old clients that we've had a relationship with for two generations now.
Right.
And at some point, that's not going to hold. I mean, we were a little off topic, but do you think, Steve, that the Saudi royal family can hold on? They're the most. They're running in an alliance with sort of Wahhabi clerics, a state that is premised on the most ascetic form of Islam probably on offer right now. And yet, for the most part, they are probably some of the most corrupt people on the planet. And you can read all about their corruption because of the strange sort of way their press works. Each one of them is always attacking the other. So for every day, a Saudi reads a story about how some, sort of royal extra-legal prince is, strung out on cocaine and a massive whoremonger. And yet their daughters, have to burn in a building because they're not properly, they don't have a proper hijab. That is a contradiction that ultimately is just, it's going to break at some point. I just don't see the Saudis holding on.
I think, just very quickly, and this can take us into Iran, I think Saudi Arabia can hold together like any other state of that sort is the exploitation of threat. I think as unstable as Iraq looks, as uncertain as Iran looks in the region, those help strike a social contract between governments and, the controlled populations in a country like Saudi Arabia, that things are so bad outside that you're better with us. And to some degree, Saudi Arabia is, I think, more stable than you think, even with some of the really clear problems there, because the instability around them is such that it makes them look good. And I think things change if Iraq were to stabilize, America were willing to, able to turn the tide in a lot of these places, Iran were to drop its nuclear pretensions, we were to deliver on an Israel-Palestine and kind of get rid of some of the convulsive reasons for jihadism, and a lot of these jihadists return to Saudi Arabia, I really think that then Saudi Arabia is looking at a real nightmare. As long as all of this other convulsive activity is going on, I think the Saudi elites are just fine.
Well, you're right about the point about exporting the threat. I don't know what to say, Steve. Welcome to the cabal. That's what neocons say.
that is
a key premise of what, at least from a foreign policy perspective, the Bush doctrine was trying to address. And I think in the end, Bush
failed.
Well, he failed. He failed in the sense of that he didn't understand that. That's a pretty revolutionary idea for American foreign policy. And so because he didn't understand the revolutionary nature of the war and the revolutionary nature of what he was saying, then he lost all credibility with it. And, would it have been a good idea in the short term? I'm sanguine in the following sense, which is that you do have this short-term immediate problem of a very well-developed and deadly, kind of terrorist movement. You have to address one way or
the
other.
We're going to be dealing with this kind of terrorism. Yeah. I think it's low-level terrorism, and I frankly think that this kind of threat is going to be there for a long time. We need to organize for it, but it ought not be the central focus of our foreign policy and national security concerns. I worry a lot about big powers and our distractions by these. But nonetheless, the other part of this that I worry a little bit about and why I think Saudi Arabia is going to be around for a while is that, you know, the thing that really bothers me, and I this is where certain neoconservatives and I agree, we do care about, I care about America's place in the world and what tools and resources America has to fight tomorrow's battles and to deal with the way, you know, shaping and sculpting a world that is better and more prosperous for all and promotes liberty, etc., 20, 30, 40, 50 years from now. My difference with the neoconservative agenda is I think that they look at it as almost an immoral act to think about costs and consequences of action, and that there are principles that should drive our behavior no matter what the cost of our interests in the near term. And a lot of this has to do with trying to engineer changes deep within a society that often breed blowback and counter-reactions that become incredibly counterproductive, that harm our ability to continue to influence. And at the end of the day, no matter how noble the purpose was, we're left with fewer resources and less leverage to do things in the future. So what's happening in the Middle East is that Iran had its chief rival removed in the region by us, and that was Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein is gone. Iraq was the cork in the bottle to Iran's very well-known ambitions to become a regional hegemonic force. And most of the region, in my view, thinks America, despite us looking at this through an American lens, but much of this area of the world looks at us as less and less significant to the outcome there, less and less important. So what the Saudis are doing is puffing up relationships, puffing up military capacity, puffing up their posture and the robustness of what they do diplomatically and militarily to try to serve as a counterweight to some of Iran's growth. And I see a sort of Cold War-like situation brewing throughout the Middle East between Saudi interests and Iranian interests, you know, with Europe and the United States on the sidelines. And I'd be very interested to see how you see that.
Well, it's pretty obvious that Bush's policy for the last year has been to create a kind of Sunni European-American alliance against Iran, given the fact that the Iranians are building a nuclear weapon, it so appears, and that they're doing this through various nodes, most notably probably the economic pressure of divestment, as well as what really is a form of economic warfare, which is to sort of tell...
Do you support divestment?
What? Yeah, of course. Why wouldn't you? I mean, I support divestment because I don't like the Iranian regime.
No, I just know that Danny Pletka and others at the American Enterprise Institute have been writing in opposition to divestment.
Who's been writing in opposition to divestment?
Danielle Pletka.
Oh, really? I have to talk to her about that. I mean,
I'm sort of interested in AEI's divergence from...
Well, I mean, I like divestment. I've always felt that... I mean, there's a problem right now in Iran because...
And for the folks watching, Danielle Pletka is head of foreign policy at the American Enterprise Institute. And I think last time I checked, pretty good, you know, well-known card-carrying neoconservative.
Yes, we don't have cards, Steve. Anyway,
okay.
I've always felt that the mullahs were deeply unpopular, were you know, in the long run their revolution had ultimately failed, that most Iranians did not want to live under a Khomeinist regime. But I now am of the opinion that, you know, I take Akbar Ghanji's word on it, that, you know, kind of open American programs to fund an opposition, which in the end would be a referendum of sorts, at least that's what he talks about, on the Constitution, that would sort of, you know, defang the power of the supreme leader, hurts them at this moment because of the, you know, I mean, the sheer brutality of their security services and so forth, and they've targeted people that they've accused even of collaborating with the Americans. There has to be a way that if they need support, they can be supported by kind of people of conscience, I think. I don't necessarily see any reason why an American flag needs to be on the money, or why Congress should be involved or something like that. Now,
so let's get the American flag off the money.
Yeah,
and
well,
get Congress out of it.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, I'm a post-Liberation Act neoconservative, I suppose, because I think that especially now it's very easy
that
to move.
That would be the wisest thing that you could write in an editorial in the New York Sun, because our active engagement in those issues turn legitimate concerns with the Al-Quds force and Ahmadinejad into these, you know, nationalist tiffs that end up empowering them rather than harming their interests with the Iranian public.
Well, I mean, I might add, for whatever it's worth, I mean, I don't know what the Blogginghead viewers think of this, but I mean, I wrote this before Trita Parsi wrote it, but I mean, I've noted the problem, but I would say a couple things. First of all, in an era of very of much better relations between the United States and Iran in 1999, we saw some of the worst crackdowns at Tehran University. So in the past, the mullahs have not needed a pretext to go after their opposition, and I don't think that their attacks on their opposition can be explained, you know, sort of like Aristotle's, you know, prime mover as a reaction all the time to American policy. I think that they have their own reasons as to why they didn't allow any reformers to run for their re-election to the Majlis in 2004, and why they wouldn't allow any serious reformers run in 2005, and why so many of Ahmadinejad's opponents say that he stole the election. I mean, I think that all those things happen for reasons that are internal to Iran. And then
why do you think they're being reversed now?
Well, I think, though, that Steve, I mean, I think that things were pretty bad for the Iranian opposition before the Axis of Evil speech, which is to say that there was a great fear of, sort of the Iranian students and Iranian activists and Iranian lawyers and Iranian human rights people before Bush was even in the White House. And, you know, the history of the repression of, for lack of a better word, Iran's liberal counter-revolution, I think really bears that out. But I've sort of wondered, like, you know, the argument for reaching out to the regime in 2000, 2001, 2002 was that you had a reformer in the presidency, and after, you know, the reform movement is demolished by the hardliners in the country, we see, you know, renewed calls for sort of talking to them. My sense of it is that there is that oftentimes your side doesn't account for the Iranian behavior itself. I mean, it's not like the Bush administration has even said we're never going to talk to you. They've said stop enriching uranium, and then we'll talk to you. And we're even willing to like give you a North Korea style deal where you can have nuclear power. But we just, you know, at this point, believe that you are trying to use this to build a nuclear weapon, and we would like some safeguards. That's a pretty Clintonian position. Yet, you know, it's, I guess, you know, in this environment, seen as the pretext for war.
Well, I mean, I guess where I disagree with you in a friendly way is that if one were to analyze carefully what Iran's drivers are, you know, and I don't disagree generally with your take on how you describe Iranian domestic political history, but when you look at what they saw us do in Iraq, I think that there was a combination of both fear inside Iran about what the United States might do to Iran. They have very good intelligence, I think, over there, and knew that, in fact, many of the neoconservatives had much more of a focus on Iran all along than they did on Iraq. They saw this lightning speed victory inside Iraq. They saw Saddam Hussein fall and run into hiding almost instantly, and that looked very formidable. And so there was a point of real weakness, and I think real, in my view, real transparency in what Iran tried to promote with us in 2003, which we walked away from. And I know you and I have discussed this, and I know that you may not have seen that Iranian proposal as a sincere one, but it gave us a measure of how they saw the interconnectedness between their support of Hezbollah and Hamas, their work with other terror networks, their view on their nuclear program, and what they mostly wanted. And what they mostly wanted from that document, which was not the 28-page rambling, ridiculous document that Ahmadinejad did later put on the table with us, but what they seemed to reflect was a promise not to engage in very active military-directed regime change and a process of normalization. And when you take, if in fact, and I'm not saying it would have succeeded, but if in fact that would have been the price for avoiding what I think could be a cataclysmic war, if one gets triggered, I don't think President Bush has predetermined that we're on a war course, like many of my liberal and progressive friends and many of your neoconservative friends have already decided will be the case. But I'm not there. I don't think you're there, that the president hasn't made that predetermined course. But But
yes,
if
yes, the president's not going going to invade Iran.
I'm sorry.
If Medya Benjamin is watching, he's not invading Iran.
Yeah. Okay. So in any case, yeah. I mean, in that particular case, I think that we saw an indication of what Iran wanted and what we should be trying to influence. So if we are trying to influence, it's not that I think we should be gaming everything because Rafsanjani is sort of seeming to be rising again in politics, but I do think we ought to do everything we can to try to prevent the populace behind Ahmadinejad and the Al-Quds and that wing of the establishment to become seen as the flag carriers, spear carriers, as the most loyal and pure, purely connected to Iranian national interests. That would be very, very damaging. And unfortunately, we have some players in our society, and a lot of them are friends of yours, who say and do things that give those people talking points and broadened political base. And that's disconcerting.
Well, I mean, if I may say a couple things. First of all, the loudest howls or the loudest assurances that the Bush administration intends to go to war with Iran are coming from the people who think my friends are war criminals. So, that I mean, just FYI, that, you know, you do have a kind of a species of journalism with regards to neoconservatives and Iran, you know, like Barnett Rubin stuff, that kind of amounts to mind reading. Secondly, back to the 2003 offer.
But, I mean, are you saying that neoconservatives aren't calling for war?
No,
with
I'm
Iran?
Saying that there are some neoconservatives like Norman Podaritz and William Kristol who think that we should be bombing the nuclear facilities, and then there are other neoconservatives who don't say that. But nobody is calling for like a kind of Iraq-style invasion, which you'd only find, you know, I think on the sort of more left-wing sides. But. Kind of.
Well, I mean, I don't know if that's fair. I mean, I think that Podhoretz, Bill Kristol, Michael Ledeen, Josh Moravchik are not just calling for bombing of nuclear facilities, they're calling for regime change.
Well,
I mean, bombing
of
nuclear
facilities, they... I'm calling for regime change in the sense that, I mean, it's the method, but sure. I don't think that this regime should be, I mean, part of the international community, and I think that they are kind of, I believe that there may have been moderates in the regime at one point, but those moderates have been squashed by the hardline elements, you know, deliberately. And
I mean, I didn't want to get you off course.
Right, but I mean, I guess I want to get back to the 2003 thing.
Yeah.
2003, it's important because there were regular high-level discussions with Zalmay Khalilzad and Javad Zarif. And in those discussions, there was talk of an exchange for the MEK. I'm sorry, and that's the Mujahideen-e Khalq, and they're a terrorist group that Saddam supported in the Iran-Iraq War and after the Iran-Iraq War against Iranian interests. And there was a talk of exchanging the MEK for at some point high level. Al-Qaeda, which included Saif al-Adel, who I'm not going to. It's very hard to say what level people are in Al-Qaeda, but he was. I've been told he's very senior, and Dick Clark says this. Richard Armitage says this. Now, in the middle of that negotiation, I believe in April or May 2003, there were a series of terrorist attacks against American interests in Riyadh, that according to Zalmay Khalilzad. And according to reports, and this has been fairly well documented, originated from Saif al-Adel when he was allegedly under this house arrest or some form of house arrest. And I think that really did destroy a lot of confidence in...
Well, the talks talked after that.
Well,
there
were talks, but I think
that really
scuttled the potential for...
Right.
And the other thing I would say is this, is that there was confidence building on both sides. The 2002 opposition meeting in London before the war included the political parties and opposition groups, mainly al-Hakim's Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq and the Dawa Party, that were ostensibly proxies of the Iranians in Iraq that were trained by the Revolutionary Guard. So the promise was eventually they would be empowered in the government, and you would have your best allies in charge in Baghdad. I don't see how that. I don't see that why that wouldn't have instilled more confidence. And yet, and we now have some evidence to suggest that the Iranians for some time had been pursuing kind of multiple strategies in Iraq, even
they're
while
pursuing
they were,
multiple strategies everywhere.
Yeah, of course, right. I'm just saying
they're supporting the Taliban and they're supporting Karzai.
A lot of times, I think that your side kind of gets into this problem, which is to say that everything the Iranians do is a reaction to something that the Americans do. When I think that we sometimes have to sort of look at their behavior. I mean, on the nuclear stuff.
No, I think Iran is not reacting to us. I think Iran is securing and consolidating its interests in the region. And that was something we should have expected once we knocked out Saddam Hussein and we were ill-prepared. We really hadn't thought that through.
Right.
Well, maybe we had. Maybe the president thought, well, we don't have to think that through because we're going to roll into Iran and topple their leadership.
Well,
I mean, maybe that was the game plan. But if you weren't going to roll into Iran and topple their leadership, knocking out their chief antagonist and rival and sort of cork in the bottle was not a smart thing to do, not to have a game plan afterward. So I think what Iran is doing, I agree with you, they're not doing it in reaction to us. They're doing it in reaction to their own security interests and treating us as if we're less and less relevant to the outcome. In fact, the Saudis are engaged in a very robust diplomacy with Iran and a competition with Iran, and they're collaborating and conflicting, and it's kind of classically and I think somewhat behind closed doors exactly what we did with the Soviets.
Right, but I would just say that I think that Iran's interest in this respect is to install this Khomeinist system, which not only I think is problematic, obviously, from a human rights perspective, but it's problematic from an overall sort of security perspective, which is to say that it is a very aggressive ideology, as we've seen the Hezbollah model in southern Lebanon. So and I think most Iraqis, by the way, even Shia Iraqis more and more we'll see, reject that Khomeinist system. They don't want a Veliyat Afaki, to use the sort of technical phrase of the rule of jurisprudence. They want representative government. So in that respect, yeah, I suppose it's sort of the interest, but I don't know if it's necessarily a kind of traditional interest of, a competing hegemon in a realist sense. I think it's the interest of a very specific ideology and what they themselves call an Islamic revolution.
No, I mean, I understand that. I hope we're not losing our audience in this.
Yeah,
but I mean,
maybe a little bit. If you can't get technical on where can you?
One of the problems with Iran, and as you said, this Khomeinist system is that I think the Khomeinist system is deteriorating inside Iran.
Yeah,
it's very interesting.
Sure.
And it's deteriorating with both the populace and the reformers.
But the reformers, though, have been knocked out of the game, at least legally speaking. I mean,
Well, Rafsanjani is...
He's not a reformer, Steve. I mean, Rafsanjani was the target of Akbar Ganji's book, where he said that he was responsible for the original chain murders of all the reformist intellectuals. Rafsanjani is somebody who...
He's a Nixonian realist in an Iranian context.
But he's not a reformer.
Yeah, he's a Nixonian realist in an Iranian context.
I don't know if he's a Nixonian realist either. I think he's a very dangerous
Khatami
guy.
Is the Democrat. Rafsanjani is the Nixonian Republican.
I don't know. I don't know if those necessarily... Right.
And I won't get Pat Buchanan mad by saying
that
Pat Buchanan
to the Ahmadinejad Bolshevik. Anyway.
Right.
Let's you know what? This is a good conversation I think we can do two more topics.
Right.
I wanted to talk about the anti-war movement if that's all right with you.
Sure.
But let me ask you first. You think they strategically screwed up. So, lay into Harry Reid.
You're asking me if Harry Reid and Pelosi?
Well, yeah. I mean, saying that you think that. I mean, let me because we were talking before, but let me just make sure I understand. Do you think that they could have ended the war with Hegel's Republicans?
Yes.
And Warner's Republicans?
Yes.
And they did not want to cut a deal, because I actually think you might be right about that. But I want to hear.
There are. Look, I'm someone who thinks that we need to take a few steps back.
Mm-hmm.
And figure out how we leapfrog into a new framework in the Middle East that assures, an American role and a Western role, but gets to a new equilibrium. I think there is no equilibrium in the Middle East, and it's very, very dangerous because you're having sort of a great game, not just about what we used to talk about, the oil regions of the Caucasus, but there's a great game about the entire damn Middle East now. And there's no point of equilibrium, and all of the kind of grooves and structures we had in place have come undone. This is really unbelievably dangerous when you think about how our history and the history of war and conflict. It's a scary time. That being said, you know, I believe, and it was in April or May of 2004, Jim Steinberg of Brookings and Michael O'Hanlon co-wrote the first major Washington Post op-ed saying that the American brand has become so tainted because of Abu Ghraib and because of other problems in the region and our failures, that the quick victory that we had has been undermined by so many other issues. And frankly, the disappointments, the disappointment of the Iraqi people in what we were doing and sort of unleashing what looked like the early stages of a civil war at that point. And they said, we need to pull out and we need to take the American flag off. We need to may find other ways to basically, you know, inject capacity into Iraq to try to hold it together, but we need to be part of something else, not necessarily an American flag running it. And I was in full agreement, and I that did not happen. But when we saw after the election and the fact that the Democratic Party took both the House and the Senate,
right.
They had, while the majority is clearly thin in the Senate, you had this phenomenon of classic Republican conservatives like Chuck Hagel, who had military experience, say, we have no strategy. You had people like Bill Odom, the former head of the National Security Agency, who's at the Hudson Institute. You know, Ken Weinstein, my buddy, head of the Hudson Institute, was at the dinner with Sarkozy and Bush last night. I mean, this is where Scooter Libby hung his hat for a while. Nonetheless, we're coming out against this war and basically saying, we need out. It doesn't mean that we can't use the withdrawal to try and precipitate some other kind of change in the region, but we need to get out. Now, the problem with the Democrats coming in and getting the Senate is that the American public ought to be looking at them as complicit in whatever history we have unfold. And in my view, Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi and leadership in the party are manufacturing what I call bare losses, where they're throwing ideas on the table, 17 different ways to get out, different time schemes, ways to cut money, and every single one of these things loses by a few votes. And you had the gift of Chuck Hagel bring on about 8 or 9 Republican senators, which was, when you lose Lieberman out of that, was not enough to circumvent a filibuster or you know, the 60-vote minimum needed to really get some traction legislatively in the way the Senate works. You really need 60 votes, more than 50 votes on these key issues. And I look at the fact that this Senate Democratic leadership, and you know, I'm a friendly critic, but they did not throw their muscle, arm twisting, and weight into doing what needed to be done, because even if they had to make concessions on the timing, concessions on the money, concessions on international force deployment, concessions on a number of other factors.
Yes.
Any one of those would have been enough to bring 2 or 3 conflicted votes over to win on one of these, and that would have then expressed a much fuller sense of the Senate, and it would have precluded President Bush's ability to drag this out. And then President Bush capped it off with the ornamental and symbolic hearings with Ryan Crocker and David Petraeus, where they were dragged into a debate about tactics and not strategy. The Democrats gave up the strategic debate at that moment,
well, not,
and it was a real crowning victory.
They accused Petraeus of being a liar, but yeah.
Well, I didn't.
Well, Steve, I have to tell you, to quote V.I. Lenin, there are no accidents. That was on purpose. The Democrats wanted to spend these 2 years in Congress, controlling Congress, trying to end the war. If only, and they would have ended the war if only there were no Republicans. There were more Democrats, and they had a Democratic president. And so they go into an election season with, like, what, 100 votes or something, where they can say vulnerable people like Norm Coleman, who may have come over at one point because of the political pressure, voted.
Norm was on every letter. Every one of those Hagel letters.
Right.
Norm Coleman was
163, times he voted, you know, to continue the war. But I would say that another reason that the anti-war effort, which I'm quite grateful has lost, is because the activists who comprise the people who kind of like do the demonstrations and who are most active about it made the argument that the war was a sin and not a blunder. You and Hagel and Scowcroft, you guys say the war in Iraq was really bad for our exercise of power, for our hegemony. It was bad for our national interest, which is fundamentally something that everyone should pursue, you know, with abandon. The left, and I'm just talking about, like, Code Pink, you know, and a lot of the major anti-war movements, for the most part, and some of the some journalists like Robert Dreyfus, really felt that like this that we America were a monster, and that they sort of bought into a lot of the really dangerous misperceptions about Iraq being this lovely place before, and not sort of seeing things in its context, and not understanding that right now most American soldiers are protecting neighborhoods in the surge from the terrorist saboteurs who are who are sort of killing less and less now, thank God, mainly Iraqis. So there was, I think, that message really turned off a vast majority of Americans, which is to say that you can get Americans to oppose the war, saying we probably can't really get the conditions of victory, and it was a big blunder for the rest of our national interests. But you're going to turn them off when, you've got so much visibility to your Medgar Benjamins of Code Pink and so forth. And I think that was another problem, is that the Democrats should have sister soldiered sort of the vocal anti-war movement and some of the vocal anti-war blogs, instead of sort of tolerating them.
You know, political movements against wars are complex, and it would be easy for me to say, well, yeah, Code Pink is too left, or a lot of Daily Kos bloggers are too left. I don't think that would be fair, because I think any political movement is, and as you know, on your side of the, I won't even call it an aisle, but your range in the corridor, is diverse, and the issues here is, yeah, there are some people that are pacifists. This is one of my big complaints with Joe Lieberman during some of the debates. I'd see Senator Lieberman around, and he would call people like me anti-war. And I said, I'm not anti-war. I'm not a pacifist. I believe in deploying power. I believe in conflict in certain way needed. But it was a way to distract from where I think you and I do disagree, which is the kind of threat that Al-Qaeda and the brand of Islamic extremism that, cost 3,000 lives on 9/11, what took place was a far greater threat in some ways that needed an immediate response, because it was so symbolic. I mean, it was a high-octane threat, non-deterrable, and we had an opportunity and the legitimacy to go into Afghanistan, take that out, and to knock out the command and control before that movement morphed into what it is morphed into, which is sort of a global movement of self-selecting cells and organizations that are going to be inspired by this sort of impulse for a long time, and we're just going to have to deal with that. But to then mission creep and change that vector into a full-on classic invasion of a classic thug who is self-dealing and rational. I mean, the best kind of dictator in the world, I mean, let's just be honest, in a realist sense, the best kind of dictator, if you're going to have dictators, is somebody who's self-dealing and rational. You can create costs and consequences, and you can channel them. And I think the world could have done that. But when we went into Iraq, I think that we gambled away a lot of our prestige and mystique, and ended up blowing it, frankly. And I think that whether you call that a sin or a blunder, maybe it's both. And that's
what
I'm
saying
now,
is that
now,
like
where
the
Code Pink is, and the real activist,
right,
anti-war crowd is, if we had had, say, instead of 3,500 deaths right now, and we had 35,000 deaths, then we would be in a Vietnam situation. And I'm not so sure that we won't be down the road, but I think it would be wrong to minimize the impact of those on the far left who are out. I think, what's interesting to watch, if people really dig into it, is their anger at Reid and Pelosi, because they were promised by Reid and Pelosi they would get in and do things. Remember Jack Murtha.
Sure.
Now, I know you were on the opposite side of that, but there is a real rage at the left. I find it fascinating to watch, because I think they're going to work very hard at purging the Democratic Party of people they think who betrayed what they were promised after the last election.
I think
What's
they're
that?
Totally overrated. I mean, I just I don't think that,
well,
there are that
you,
many
you
Americans
may be right,
who agree
but
with them. I think that they're just loud and vocal on the
no,
internet.
I'm not saying
it seems
I agree
like
with
a lot
them.
Of them. No, I'm not
you
saying
think
you
I
agree with them. I just don't think
yeah.
I don't think that they have a popular. They have a potentially popular message, which kind of gets to the. I mean, this sort of gets us into the thing we originally were going to start off with, which
right.
is that I think that in because of the times that we're in, and because of the sort of outgrowth of blogs on the internet, your blog has become a hub for a strange alliance between this like left that we're describing, which I think is a deeply anti-American left, and then a very, you know, realist kind of traditional conservative group that also couldn't, I mean, it was...
I should have worn my American flag.
No, I'm not
right
saying
now.
You're anti-American. I'm saying that...
Yeah.
Read your commenters, though, Steve.
Seriously, yeah, I know.
Those commenters, some of them are insane. Anyway, but then also this, you know, kind of traditional Republican realist, you know, George H.W. Bush Republicans, and that they break down on the fundamental point about American power. Scowcroft, and I think you, and I think, you know, even to a certain and to a certain sense, clearly like a Dick Clark, who are very critical of the neoconservatives, are
right.
interested in maximizing American power and extending American hegemony. I think that the hard left, coming from kind of Chomsky tradition, out of the activism against the World Bank and the IMF, are interested fundamentally, as a basic question, of diminishing American hegemony because they see it kind of, you know, tainted from its inception, which is to say that it will always be imperialist, it will always be crushing, you know, native movements, and in fact, you know, that, you know, it's all, you know, the stuff about how American soldiers are protecting Iraqis, well, that's just a pack of lies, because the whole war is Halabja, the whole war is Haditha, the whole war is Abu Ghraib, and that is a lie. And that is something that most Americans are not going to believe. And ironically, when there was a strategy of trying to get veterans of the war...
I agree with that.
The veterans of the war to sort of say how terrible it was, if you really want to turn off members of the armed services and drive them into the Giuliani camp, then, you know, please put out front and center your typical coast blocker. I mean, there's no, you can't ask for a better endorsement.
Well...
And that's why I'm really surprised at Hillary. I mean, I'm convinced that Hillary, as soon as she gets the nomination, and I wrote this, will sprout wings and grow talons and start calling for the blood of every Iranian terrorist. I'm pretty convinced that that's where she's going. But I'm surprised she hasn't already really kind of taken an opportunity to say, this is utterly, you know, this is crazy. This is not where I am, and I don't think that this is where the Democratic Party is. When confronted with some of the more hard left voices in, you know, that are kind of coming from that. And I think that, by the way, they voted for Nader in 2000, which clearly cost Gore the election.
Right.
And so I understand the argument for why you want to keep the left in the party if you're a Democrat. But at the same time, I think it may be careful what you wish for.
Well, you know, just to be clear, I'm an independent.
Yeah.
Just so you know, disagree with you that my blog, as I write it, reflects that far left view.
No, it doesn't. I'm just saying that they love you.
They cling to it.
They love you. They love you in the credulous world.
I don't quite understand why, but nonetheless.
All right.
You know, I think that the fundamental issue of what I'm trying to do, because I am trying to build an alliance. You have many friends in the neoconservative camp. Many of them I've known for a very, very long time and are friends and come to my house and are parties with, et cetera. And I kind of said, you know, it's sort of like the Green Party or the FDP in Germany. It's okay when you're on the, you know, in the game but on the fringe, but you shouldn't have the chancellorship. They're not ready for it, and they weren't. And the neoconservatives largely, both because of the excellent organization skills that they have, the popularization of the message, the times we were in, and the laziness of the realists and the laziness of the classic liberal internationalists, the neocons zoomed ahead and basically took controls of American foreign policy. And I've been trying to basically organize, you know, sense what I consider to be in my book, sensible 21st century realists. I don't think the old classic Kissingerian, Nixonian realism works in the 21st century. I think you have to worry about what's going on inside other countries, but there are very limited ways in which you can influence that. And I very much worry about the fact that we fought the Cold War. I think we fought the Cold War successfully, and we organized ourselves and our relationships and our superpower apparatus to deal with the Soviets. They fell apart. But we've been trying to maintain a large superstructure and apparatus that we built to deal with the Soviet Union that's ill-prepared to deal with a lot of other things. And I think that that reality is coming, and this superstructure that we've created is coming crashing down, whether we want to acknowledge that or not. And we need to quickly reorganize and think about what our purpose is in the world, what our allies are allied to do, how do you connect the economic interests we have as a nation and as a global system to our security interests, and we've got to leapfrog out of a very quickly deteriorating mess. And that, and that's why I agree with my friend Flint Leverett, an incremental approach, which I think both, you know, both I think Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton are as guilty of right now in the material I've read as George W. Bush. The kind of incremental approaches we have don't work. There may be certain incremental approaches we need to take sheerly for moving ahead the next day, but at the same time, we're not doing what we did in 47, 48, and pulling aside our best and brightest and the great and the good, and to figure out how we reassemble, given the costs and the real reality of where we're at today. Forget platitudes. Forget whether we're triumphalists or declinists, and really think about how do you reassemble this. It is not a trivial parlor game when you look at what's going on in the Middle East. It is not a trivial parlor game when I talk to the Deputy Director of Policy Planning in China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and he jokingly says when I ask him what he's doing, and he says, well, we're trying to figure out how to keep you distracted by small Middle Eastern nations because it's so good for us. I mean, there are really big issues out there that have to be confronted and dealt with. And I think that getting lost in you know ideological gambits one way or another is a mistake. So I am trying, and I think with some limited success, to take back some of that turf from your neoconservative friends and get a greater balance in foreign policy here.
If I could just address something you said very early. I, the neoconservatives, I've always think you kind of overestimated the power of the neoconservatives and the control that they had of any. At any point, and I would point out that Liberal Internationalists largely supported the war in Iraq.
Yes, they did. But I did not.
Right. I know, but as did quite a few. I mean, I think Kissinger supported the war with Iraq. So it was not a.
Kissinger today is not what he was, you know, 20 years ago.
Fair enough. Okay.
I mean, well,
I don't know if that's
Kissinger
a good thing or a bad thing. Anyway, you know, 20.
No, he was quoted in his monthly meetings with Cheney of saying the only way out of Iraq is victory. That is not a realist.
All right. Well, I mean, I would say this that I mean my take on what Bush did is that he had plenty of realist input into how to sort of how to implement a grand of maybe a possibly you could say a neoconservative project. And that it failed because there were major kind of contradictions in the aims of what realists and neoconservatives thought and wanted to do when confronted with 9/11. Flint Leverett is very influential in setting up and strengthening all of the alliance with the autocratic states in Asia after 9/11. The hopes, I think, basically of subcontracting that war. Kind of getting back to our original topic, we see the limits of that approach today in Pakistan, where you know you don't always get what you think you're getting in terms of successful prosecution of the war. Al-Qaeda has expanded in the last 3 years, and you also suffer a deficit of democracy, which I think in the end, where I've really moved, I guess, is that I don't know that the U.S. government can be the primary instrument in helping along democratic movements, and I think that more and more I'm coming around to the view that you've got to do that through parallel institutions which are not uniquely American and are also probably not...
What would be an example of those?
Well, I mean, I think that, like, you know, you're seeing Jimmy Hoffa's Teamsters Union supporting the Iranian bus drivers in Iran. That's one example. When there was a judge's strike in Egypt, I thought that the American Bar Association should have tried to come up with a fund for the striking justices and should have lobbied on their behalf. I think that in terms of money, I don't see any reason why excellent democratic liberal politicians like Mithal Al-Alusi in Iraq cannot raise money like any other politician among concerned Americans here. And I just think that the only really role of the government is to just make sure that obvious terrorist groups like Hezbollah cannot rely on financial support in our country, but, you know, sort of giving a kosher seal of approval to liberal Democrats and to try to sort of make sure that those operations that support these groups are done on the terms of the actual liberal Democrats and not, you know, as part of something that we turn on and off as part of a kind of grand strategy to negotiate or pressure other countries. So, I mean, that's kind of where I am. I haven't really put
you
the
sound,
in a
you
big
sound
essay
like an
yet.
Ethical realist all of a sudden, Eli.
What?
You sound like an ethical realist all of a sudden.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, these are all just sort of labels. I mean,
right. But let me provoke you just for a moment, though. I mean, not to put a label on it, but that you're basically talking about partnering institutions, trying to build civil society from the sort of genuine within, collaborative competency building with parts of civil society, for which there could be some cost for these institutions, you know, in these yeah. Illiberal regimes. But without getting into the politics of saying, do you like him or do you not like him, that is exactly
what Soros has done.
But it's also kind of what, to some degree, what the National Endowment for Democracy has been doing, which has been headed by Carl Gershman, who is labeled by most as a neoconservative, but I don't see Carl that way, and it's what the International Republican Institute and the National Democratic Institute have been trying to do. I think that what's interesting is I think Soros, by far, has been the most successful at doing it with clear and tangible results, and it's very disconcerting, and it's one of the things I really admire about Secretary Rice and also about Steve Hadley, is that they've been as equally worried about the expulsion of institutions like OSI from Russia and the treatment, along with the Wilson Center scholar and others. There was an OSI, Open Society Institute, sort of collaborator who was also detained inside Iran. And I think it's very interesting because, let's forget the name of OSI or George Soros for a moment, but that kind of approach would really give us some common ground to look at both costs and consequences of how you move, how America can be about great things, but dealing with the internal organic elements within an illiberal regime and trying to cultivate those without the kind of muscular Wilsonianism that neoconservative has been about so far. I've just finished reading Jacob Halbrin's excellent new book called We Thought We Were Right, or They Thought They Were Right, the rise and fall of the neoconservative movement that's just coming out in December. And he makes the point that neoconservatism has been about a lot of things, and some of these things have even been in conflict with one another. So I fully expect the neoconservative movement to morph into some new directions. Maybe you'll be at the helm of that direction.
We'll see. The one thing I would say is that there should be, at a certain point, diplomatic penalties for states that, I mean, I would like to sort of build, I like the idea of a community of democracies that can be a diplomatic component of it, but, let's just say it, the U.S. government is not going to invade another country for at least a generation. Iraq is it. We don't have the military for it, we want a volunteer military, we don't want to institute a draft for a variety of reasons.
But you think we won't invade, but you do think we might bomb.
Well, I mean, since we're talking right now, I'm not in love with air power. I'm not under the impression that if the Iranians have a diffuse and secret nuclear enrichment program that we would eliminate all of it in a bombing run. And, I wrote in my column last week that there are a lot of consequences of that. Though I think that you sort of have to kind of keep that option on the table, and I think that if it's possible that you can get very precise targeting information and you can take a shot at Osama bin Laden, I think we would both agree, if you did that with a missile as opposed to a SWAT team, that would be good, right?
No, I think it should have been done 6 years ago.
Yeah.
7 years ago.
In Tora Bora, you mean?
8 years ago. I mean, I agree with you there. I don't think bin Laden are dealing with that as the issue. I do think that Tehran and Iran are a very different issue. I mean, one thing I want to ask
think,
about
I think,
the president,
I think, yeah.
what did you write about the president's World War III comments?
I don't remember exactly what I wrote. I think I quoted him in a news story, but on the World War III comments, I think that he was simply saying if Iran was to get a nuclear weapon, that would be, or was close to getting a nuclear weapon, that would be a provocation of a world war, because it's not just Israel. I mean, you've got the Saudis. You pointed out the Saudis. Well, there's a lot of people who don't want Iran to get a nuke, and in part it's because of what Iran's behavior has been since the Islamic Revolution in terms of supporting terrorist groups in the region, and they think that that's a dangerous combination. I think it's a dangerous combination. So I think he was sort of trying to make a fine point on the fact that, we, the civilized world, need to come up with a way to stop them from getting nukes. In this respect, I disagree with Abizaid or Matthew Iglesias that it would be something that, ultimately they would be deterrable and we could live with it and it's not such a big deal.
Well, I think, this is a very long road. You know, we're not at that point yet. But
yeah.
I always believe that you need to counter, think through every scenario. If they had nukes today and we're not developing them, it requires us to think about what an Iran with nukes looks like. David Sanger of the New York Times wrote a piece about that, which was quite instructive. And, there are debates among very smart people.
Yeah.
Ash Carter, who thinks that strategic readjustment, which was essentially appeasement of an Iran having a bomb, is something that he thinks would yield, would generate an Iran that would remain behind a shield, a nuclear shield, and continue to meddle in, the affairs of other countries and continue to animate its terror networks. I was in a session with Joe Nye, who said, we really need to go back to different assumptions and ask ourselves why that would be the case and look at it. And I think it's important to avoid platitudes. It doesn't mean you should appease Iran's worst behaviors. But I do think that there are scenarios that we may not be able to stop that force us to come back and say, are we willing, given this circumstance, to risk, and maybe the risk is worth it, but to risk really the end of American primacy, and a lot of viewers are going to get really angry at me for saying that, but American primacy over the oil world. And I, for one, think we're not ready for that yet.
Well, some people would say,
you're all about oil, Steve. And I'm not. I'm about American strategic interests and the way the world is assembled. And it's going to reassemble itself, and we're going to become a relatively smaller part of that over time. But we can really quickly speed up history here, and it would be incredibly detrimental to the quality of life of Americans. And I think, frankly, a disaster for the world. I believe in America, what we used to be about, what we are about is in terms of our form of democracy, civil society, justice. I'm not one of these anti-Americans. I'm a patriot, and I want to see the great things about our society, to benefit others. But I think there are some things that we could do that would be really clear disasters. But that doesn't mean we should appease. But what I need you to do on your side of the aisle is to recognize to people we can't do foreign policy and national security on the cheap either. It can't just be Hillary Clinton saying the IRGC is a terrorist outfit and that strengthens our diplomats' hands. It also needs to be putting on the table the carrots, the positives, the outreach to the Iranian public.
There is a huge amount of carrots, though, on the table. The Iranians,
I don't know if the Iranian public is sensing those carrots.
Well, the Iranian public, I think...
Do you think there's a congressional resolution that Hillary signed off that shows those carrots? I haven't seen
one. Well, no, but I'm saying that the history, that congressional resolution didn't come out of thin air because people don't like Iran, Steve. It came out because the Iranians have been brazenly enriching uranium after agreeing that they would avoid censure in 2003 from the UN Security Council resolution by giving unhindered inspections, which they never did, to the IAEA, and...
Yeah.
Stopping their program when they decided just on their own to even reject what I think is a pretty crappy North Korea deal, there had to have been consequences, and I might add these are consequences short of bombing them and short of, which is not even an option, invading them. So that's, I think, what that's about, which is that I think that, if you want to avoid this kind of conflict, especially since, there's also the Israel factor, I think that the Israelis at a certain point, if they felt that they were very close to assembling the A-bomb, they would try to do their best to take out what they could. So if you want to avoid that, or as it were, as the president said, World War III, then you've got to sort of get tough right now. And I think that the reason the IRGC, was designated as such is because the IRGC controls quite a bit of the Iranian economy, and it was a way of trying to coerce, cajole, more, the belief that there are more reasonable people in that regime who would not want to build a nuke. I think it's not going to work, by the way. I think that they understand, the Iranians know, that if they get a nuke, they will get the sovereign respect and equality that all the other nuke states get. Nobody ever talks about an India or a Pakistan, Liberation Act. Right?
No. I mean, there's a lot of truth to what you say. But we need a new game, a fuller game on Iran. And it's going to be very messy. I'm with you. I think that this president is not going to go out and hatch a war with Iran. But one of the really interesting problems we have, if you look at Israel, which we haven't discussed that much, but if you look at Israel, you look at Iran, you look at the United States, you look at Palestine, it is remarkable how fragmented each of these governments are. Now, Israel less so. I think everyone recognizes Olmert, the president, of course, you know, the prime minister, but of course, you know, they recognize President Bush as the president. But you really don't know how Bush makes decisions or what decisions he'll make. You kind of know what Cheney's decisions will be, and you kind of know what Bob Gates or Condi Rice will view something to be. But we're in an era where leadership is opaque, and these opaque leaders are playing out rivalries within their own governments and trying to make us all guess as what they really think. It's very weird and dangerous. Yes. Anytime. Great. We'll sign you up for our side of the aisle one of these days. We've got cards. We'll give you a card. All right. Take care now. Bye.